Hi, everybody. I'm Scott. In our last podcast, Julie, Seth, and I were talking about Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien. Our discussion went way too long for one podcast, and when we ended the last one, we had just hit intermission. So we're going to pick this one up right at the end of intermission. Hope you enjoy it. Chapter 7 is The Mirror of Galadriel. Is that where we're at?
That's about right.
Okay. Yeah. So, so what we've got, Galadriel is very powerful. You know, she's the one that had the ring, right?
Yeah.
And what were there, 3 elven rings? Is that correct?
Yeah, there's Narya, Nenya. Nenya's the one she has, and I can't remember the name of the other one.
Cool.
Oh my gosh, you know their name?
A couple of them.
I bow to you, sir.
I love it.
I don't know any of the dwarf. I don't know if the dwarvish rings have names, but
we couldn't say that language anyway. It's impossible.
Yeah. Their jawcracker dwarf language must be.
So this is the chapter where there's a big thing that happens in here. Frodo basically says to Galadriel, "Here, take this ring."
Mm-hmm.
And she's got a choice to make. That was a very powerful moment. And what did she choose?
She chose to remain Galadriel and diminish and go into the West.
Yeah. So isn't that's an interesting thing. So again, you know, we're talking about they're going to fade away and stuff. And that's exactly how she puts it. Where I'm going to diminish and go to the West. So she's making this decision and kind of going into the unknown, I think. Do you feel like she knows what's going to happen?
No, I don't feel like she does.
She knows that she's going to diminish and go to the West, but I don't know that she knows exactly what that means for her.
But she's the second powerful person. You notice Frodo keeps trying to give this ring to somebody else who could do something with it, because they're better equipped, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Tried to give it to Gandalf, who said, whoa, I do not need that kind of temptation. And I know myself. I know I would fail.
Done. Right, right.
Mm-hmm. And then he offers it to Galadriel, who also says that, but she tells more specifically what she would do. So you kind of wonder, has she already thought about it?
Yeah, clearly she
it
has.
Seems like it.
Clearly
it
she
yeah.
has.
And this was brought up again on the Corey Olson's podcast, but it's something I've thought about a great deal, is this is where you start to see a lot Tolkien's doubling. And just to jump ahead a bit, we know that Boromir tries to take the ring from Frodo. And each of them, Galadriel and Boromir, have a long speech they give about what you could do with this ring. But Galadriel is explaining what would happen. She's already thought about it. Her choice has been made before now. You get the feeling. Boromir is reveling in the fantasy. He is letting his imagination run wild, and he's ready to take the ring. So he's revving himself up. He's not even trying to resist.
And
so we're shown, here are the two ways you can react.
Well, doesn't Sam have a vision of what he would do with the ring later? I'm trying to remember this, but like kind of turning the world into this giant garden.
It shows how pure he is, because he would make the world a garden, and the ring's like, serious? This is what you would do with me? Give up. I'm like, that's the worst power fantasy ever.
Oh,
all
shoot.
Of you, garden.
Double rainbow.
Flowers for everyone.
All the way across Middle Earth.
Yep.
But Sam does have a choice he has to make here, because this is one of his chances to turn back. He sees something bad happening to the Shire. He's like, where's the gaffer going with that wheelbarrow, and what's happening? And they're tearing down all the trees. And
yeah, well, he's looking in the Mirror of Galadriel, and that's what he sees, is the Shire. Yep, getting, so he's got a decision to make now. Do I go back and help them, or do I keep going forward?
Yeah.
So.
And the seeming good would be, I could go help those people, Mm-hmm. Look at all the people you have to help you, Frodo.
Right, right.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah, not knowing what the future holds. But then he concludes that he's got to go with Frodo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and also this is where Frodo first experiences the eye.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep,
I forgot that was here.
Yeah.
And that it could know him and look for him.
Yeah. I was just going to say, this is the first time I realized what the eye actually was, but that's a little bit ahead too. So I'll wait till we get to Saruman.
I cannot wait to hear this because I don't think I know. Okay. Yeah. Don't forget this part.
All right. Hopefully I've got it correct.
Well, it's more than I've got, which is it looks like a giant cat eye.
Yep.
Yeah. Sounds cool. Terrible.
Okay. So Galadriel lets him go. And she gives them a bunch of gifts, like more +2 swords and and ropes of awesomeness and things like that.
Yeah. She knew Sam needed that rope.
Yeah. And Sam had been talking about rope.
That's
so cool.
He took the rope, right? The elves gave him the rope. She gives him the earth,
that's right.
Which is much later.
Yeah. Yeah.
The rope is just part of the regular gear right. and tackle they get.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. And then, she gives him some earth. Gimli gets some hair.
Yeah, and that's just beautiful to me. As a symbol of reconciliation between, whether you want to call it race conflict or whatever it is, it's
mm-hmm.
the symbolism there is really, really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And Gimli's subsequent kind of almost teenage infatuation did she send me a message? Did she say anything about me? Oh no.
Wait, you said somebody else was prettier? Come on, out in the back alley. We're doing it out right now.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to kick your butt for saying bad things.
No one's prettier than you. Done.
Yeah. I'll teach you fair speech under my rod.
Exactly. Cool. So, then they leave there. Farewell to Lorien is chapter 8. And then chapter 9 is the Great River. And chapter 10, the Breaking of the Fellowship. So here's where Boromir makes his move. And, Frodo is also feeling the ring. It's becoming more and more of a burden. Pretty much after he sees that eye, wouldn't you think? Feels like things have changed right there.
Yeah, that is that's a good shifting point.
Yeah, so things have changed. Now it's always described as a heavy weight, and it just seems like he's not well anymore.
Yeah.
After that. And so he's starting to have thoughts about leaving as well. It kind of all coincides. And then Boromir's action makes him make that final decision where he's like, I don't want to burden anyone else with this. I'm going to leave by myself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Gollum is also introduced in these.
Right.
That's right.
So he's mentioned off and on.
Yeah.
The elves see him in Lorien, and then he's sort of seen on a log. And so I think that, that has to be the weight of the past history of the ring. Is got to be heavy on Frodo's mind because Gollum is showing up. He's kind of aware of his presence, and so he's aware of what the ring does to people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and also when it says, Boromir says, I've only seen the ring for a second in the House of Elrond. Could I not have a sight of it? Frodo looked up. His heart went suddenly cold. He caught the strange gleam in Boromir's eyes, yet his face was still kind and friendly. And that's the very same thing, I think, as he felt when Bilbo saw the ring. His whole face changed, and I think it's that, that was a foreshadowing of what happens. He's suddenly like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
And that's when he knows, it's got a hold on you without you ever touching it. And so I hadn't thought about Gollum reinforcing that, because Gollum is what Bilbo would have been if he hadn't given it up himself.
Yeah, and then there's this added thing. Frodo sees Gollum every now and then, but doesn't mention it to anyone. And then when he finally feels like he needs to, isn't it Aragorn he tells? And Aragorn says, oh, yeah, I've noticed him. I've known he's there. I'm a ranger, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
You know, but why do you think Frodo wasn't mentioning it to anybody?
That's a good question.
Like, I mean, he's hoping against hope he was wrong.
Yeah, I mean, part of it, I think, is there is, and, you know, some of this can be justified within the story, and I think some of this is a plot device. I mean, you see it with TV shows like Lost. It was one of the complaints about Lost is that people don't share knowledge.
Uh-huh.
It's like, okay, I just saw this smoke monster thing. You'd think I'd go tell everyone about it. So, like, I mean, we were talking about it earlier, and it works great on a metaphorical level of, oh, Gandalf fell. I don't know what he had intended for this point. But, I mean, seriously, if you're planning a trip to Mordor, you're going to at least lay out some waypoints along the way. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm obviously the biggest Tolkien fan, but he says himself in the preface, you know, there's much to be criticized in this book, great and small. And then he says, fortunately, I'm under no obligation to rewrite this thing. So deal with it.
Thank goodness.
That's cool. Yeah.
Well, and at some point though, also, I think doesn't Sam feels like he sees some eyes at one point? And so
he does. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he might tell Frodo, but they don't go around telling everybody else. And I think they're afraid of looking stupid. You know how that idea of, yeah, well, I felt like this, but I don't want to tell anyone because that's just dumb.
Yeah, yeah.
I kind of think it's that thing.
Okay.
Too.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was wondering if you felt protective of Gollum.
I don't think.
If he knew it was Gollum and telling anyone, if he's like, well, if I tell people that he's going to be dead.
No, I just think he feels like, no, because remember, he's the one who was like, I wish he was dead. And Gandalf's the one who has to shake him out of it. I think he feels like, I hope it's not him.
Yeah.
And I don't want to tell anyone because I feel stupid.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That was just my feeling on
that
it.
That makes sense, yeah.
I don't think he said it. But.
All right.
Then this is the point that I think was one of the most interesting things that I'd never figured out for myself. The breaking of the fellowship is Boromir trying to take the ring. He doesn't die until the beginning of the next book. That's the fellowship is done. I mean, that's it's not him dying. You think that's it.
Right, right.
Or Frodo leaving. But Frodo's all that happens is precipitated because he tries to take the ring.
Yeah.
That's what breaks it.
Yep.
Yeah, that is a good point.
For me, that was huge. I never realized that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an excellent point. Yeah, and it sure is.
Well, I'd so like Frodo, to say it's mine, but it
isn't. Then Frodo, he decides that's it. He's going off on his own, and Sam goes with him.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful scene too.
Yeah, it's another one of those Sam Frodo moments. You know, Sam's not going to let him go without him. So, yeah.
And just to back up a little bit.
Go ahead.
There's those when they're on the river, there's that scene with the Argonauth, those giant statues of the kings of old.
And it
kind of creeps the heck out of the rest of the company because Aragorn's all of a sudden like, oh, yeah, those are my people right there. And he kind of has this transformation. They're like, oh, how is it like, oh, what the heck happened to Strider?
Mm-hmm. He's gone. Strider's not there.
Yeah, so it's the first glimpse of, you know, what's to come.
Yeah. True.
Yeah, he's kind of interesting because as you watch, that's to him, I think, the first sign. And he's kind of always looking for that kind of thing of, is this the time? Is this the time? And you can imagine his father may have been that way and his father before him. He doesn't know any more than anyone else. But he's like, ah, here I am.
Yeah.
It could be time. You know, it's an interesting, eager anticipation in that way. And then everybody's scattered.
Now we're, everybody's scattered and we're in the Two Towers.
And what, did this guy know how to write cliffhangers or what? Can you imagine when this book came out and the next book wasn't out yet?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Is that how it was done? I know they broke it up and then I wonder if he actually did any writing. Because it really, you know, it really is one book.
No, I think he had it all done and then because it was wartime, I think. They said, we don't have the paper, man. That was a very practical consideration. They were also afraid people wouldn't buy it because it was so big. And so they put the first one out and everybody was clamoring for more. That's my understanding of it. I think I read
it. Okay, that's interesting. So it was a big hit at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a huge hit. People couldn't wait.
Oh, and that's
to the point
cool.
of where when you I mean, we've all read about the angry letters he got over the very end of the book, the very, very end.
Mm.
Where people were so the end of getting rid of the ring. I mean, people were writing him, I guess these days it would be death threats, but back then it was horrible, angry letters for women even going, "What? Frodo did what? You ruined this book. Done."
Yeah, I guess I don't understand. What were they upset about? That he was
that he failed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That he said,
"I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm keeping
you didn't
this
feel
ring.
That way when you first read it.
I'm
even,
keeping this
oh,
ring.
Not caring that much. Went. What the hell just happened?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I guess too.
I guess I felt. I don't know. It felt right to me. Like. Yeah, and then Gollum, yeah. Is Gollum the hero of the book?
Yeah, no.
Well, not a hero, and not even really redeemed, but he had his part to play.
As yeah, well. Yeah, pretty much.
But he would get letters, and that's why I'm eager to read the letters, because some of those letters are in there.
I need to read the letters, yeah. I've not.
Oh, you haven't read them?
Where would one read those letters?
Oh, there's a book. I mean,
there's a book
published.
Of them.
Called The Letters of J.R.R. Tolkien?
Yeah.
And
something like that, yeah.
And his hate mail is in there, too?
It might be.
Yeah, this, and I was really disappointed when, because I downloaded the sample on my Kindle, and I was looking at it, and I was like, these are the selected letters. And I went, selected? And they're like, because he had so many, and a lot of them weren't about anything you care about. And I went, oh, okay.
Would you care to join me for tea?
Yeah.
My room's at Merton College on Thursday. Even in the 24th.
We're going to talk about the Norse view of Thor and the philology of his many names or something.
Yeah.
So
that's too funny.
Well, so then we're into the Two Towers, which is the second.
The Two Towers.
Yeah. And what are the Two Towers? That's a.
Oh,
it
that's
seems
a
like
debate,
it can be a debate. Yeah, that's what I've heard.
It is a debate.
Oh, is it?
Isengard
Sauron's
Tower.
But then some people propose
Minas Ithil, the Tower of the Moon, you know, that's near Shelob's lair as the second tower. It's one of those purely academic debates that really doesn't matter.
Well, wasn't Sauron and his gang all in the opposite of Minas Tirith?
Sauron is not in that. The opposite of Minas Tirith is like the Tower of the Sun or the Tower of Guard is what Minas Tirith means. Minas Ithil is where the Black Riders are based out of.
Okay. So, that's the second tower. Done. Oh,
okay.
I'm sorry.
All right. All right. Cool. Moving on.
Well, no, because they go and get it and fix it up.
Yeah,
that's,
I mean,
huge spoiler, but you know.
Yeah, it's true.
Simplification.
Yeah, no, I agree, because that tower definitely, because Barad-dûr, Sauron's fortress, doesn't really feature in this book, and barely even features in the third one.
Well, yeah. I guess it's in this one. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. There's a lot of towers. Well, I think what's maybe more interesting is, couldn't it be all of them? Because you've got Sauron and you've got, where's the big battle that I should remember this, that, you know, in the movie there was dwarf tossing. And
oh, Helm's Deep. Yeah.
Helm's Deep.
Never toss a dwarf.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was horrible.
I know. That's a whole different conversation.
Oh, boy.
But you also have, where Eowyn and Eomer and, what's his name? The king, Theoden?
Yeah.
Can't believe I can remember these
Edoras,
names. People.
Yeah.
This is the power of a slow read. I remember these names. I could make an argument that, that's the opposite of where Saruman is too, I can see all kinds of parallels. Yeah. And I think to me, this book has got so many parallels. You could almost look at the people that way too, right?
Oh, big time. I mean,
you've got Theoden and Denethor and.
Yeah. Although Denethor doesn't really show up until the third book, but you've got parallels all over the place. Boromir and Faramir, most notably, and you've got the redemption of Boromir opening the book, and then later you've got Faramir.
Oh yeah, and he's kind of at the end, isn't he?
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I want to bring up the movies too much, but I really wished that Tolkien had structured the book more similar. The reason I didn't quite finish this reread is I was so dreading reading book four and like slogging through the marshes for a book with Frodo and Sam and Gollum. And there's wonderful stuff in there, but just, you know, it feels like a Samuel Beckett play almost sometimes because there's like so few characters and there's so, you know, there's this great kind of philosophical discussion going on, but I just, it feels, and you guys were mentioning earlier about Tolkien's power to set a mood and set an ambiance. And so I just didn't want to go through all the sharp rocks and the marshes and you know, all that stuff. Yeah. I didn't want to do it. So I put it off for quite a while.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I think about that, and you'd think the thing that would make me dread it as much as that would be the fact that when he was in World War II, oh, he was in some he was in a lot of horrible battles, but one horrible or World War One. Which one did I say? Anyway, whatever he fought in, one. There was a big battle where hardly anybody lived, and he was one of the ones who lived. And to get out of there, you were having to crawl a lot of the time. And the mud was so mixed with all the bodies of the dead that it was very much like those marshes.
Wow, yeah.
And that's where a lot of the – and they think that's where maybe a lot of the imagery came from. And to me, suddenly, that made it not some horrible, like, Stephen King-type imagination. It made it into something so real and pitiful that I actually began to not look forward to it, but to kind of treasure it as, I don't know, just because I knew that that there was something like that, it mm-hmm. made it mean something to me, I guess.
Yeah, it wasn't it more just meaningful, imagination. Right.
Yeah, I can understand that.
That's when I quit hating it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Sam gets to see an Ollie font, so, you know,
oh, yeah.
I'm always going for that part.
Way to go, yeah. Sam. You bet.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Heck yeah. Heck yeah.
And that actually is the beauty of having Sam along, because even though Frodo is getting increasingly drugged down and gray and everything, Sam's still got that. He's just Sam. He's along like the part, just to jump way ahead of when it's the end of this book, I think when they're the... the orcs have Frodo and they're like, yeah, no one will get anything. And Sam says, oh, really? You've forgotten about that great big elf word you're afraid of. And he goes running after them with his sword. Yeah. Like, oh, Sam.
He's the constant Tolkien. Gardener.
Yeah. He's that bit of comic relief we need.
Yep. Optimist.
Yep.
Ever the optimist.
Yeah.
So cool. So, after Frodo leaves, all the rest of the fellowship is attacked by orcs and Boromir passes away. And here's where everybody splits. Merry and Pip get taken by orcs who are looking for halflings.
Yep.
Gimli, the elf.
Legolas.
Legolas. And Aragorn, and Aragorn are together, and they have a decision to make. And I think their decision is interesting. They get to decide whether to follow Frodo or follow Merry and Pip, and they decide to follow Merry and Pip.
Right.
Well, even before that, there's an interesting thing when Boromir, Aragorn manages to catch Boromir before he dies, and Boromir's like, I failed. I mean, he realizes the enormity of what he's done, and like, I failed. And Aragorn says, no, you've conquered. So, you know, even though his actions were, you know, awful in terms of chasing Frodo and all that stuff, even just the realization that that was wrong is redemptive, which I thought was really, you know, really wonderful.
Yeah. Very Catholic too.
Yeah.
That is a Catholic, you know, confession type of a situation.
I was looking at that. Yeah. And when he says, no, you have conquered. Few have gained such a victory. Be at peace. Minas Tirith shall not fail. And I was just reading that.
Oh, man.
And it brought tears to my eyes.
Yeah.
Because I'm just like,
oh my God.
And he smiles and he never says anything else. He dies. That's the redemption he needed and the absolution.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, because he sacrificed himself for those two little hobbits.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
His sacrifice and, you know, his realization of what he'd done. And, mm-hmm. and then when Aragorn's thinking, he's like, may I make a right choice and change the evil fate of this unhappy day? And so he says, well, you know, I wouldn't have abandoned Frodo. I'd have gone with him to the end. But if I seek him now in the wilderness, I must abandon the captives to torment and death. My heart speaks clearly at last. The fate of the bearer is in my hands no more. The company has played its part. Yet we that remain cannot forsake our companions while we have strength left. Let's go. And mm-hmm. so, one more time. Well, here would be the clever thing. I can help him get to Mordor. No, mm-hmm. I'm going to go after these hobbits.
Yeah.
Because clearly leaving them to be tormented would be the wrong thing to do.
Yeah. And also, it was sort of implied, you know, in the whole formation of the Fellowship, you know, this thing is not going to succeed because of numbers. You know, one more person, even someone as legendary as Aragorn, is not in the end going to
Right.
to a hill of beans.
Right. Well, and he's kind of good at kind of like, where's the flow going? That's where I should be. And
that's a great one.
well, because there's also the thing later on. It gets pointed out that if Merry and Pippin served no other purpose than Boromir's redemption, their coming along was worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I don't think I ever really thought about that.
Yeah, that's Gandalf says it.
Man, that's really good.
Yeah. And so that is really Catholic.
Yeah.
Everybody is worth trying to redeem to the very end. And we see that with Gollum too, really.
Yeah.
That's I'll talk about that later, but
yeah. But so they're chasing, so Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli are chasing the orc party, and Legolas sees an eagle. And you don't realize what it is until later, but
it's really
neat. Yeah, that is cool that they did that. Yeah. Yep. So cool. So then they come upon the Riders of Rohan.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Eomer. Oh,
this is where I have a few movie images. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Carl Urban.
I didn't know who Carl Urban was till later. And then somebody said, and he was also this person. I went, what? How did he look so different? And I went, well, whatever he looked like, it was a look that worked for him. I'm just saying.
Yeah. So yeah, they tell Aragorn and them that there was a big fight and we haven't seen any hobbits, but all your orcs are dead. And the hobbits have gone into Fangorn Forest. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay, yeah. So they're into the Fangorn Forest where they meet Treebeard. And Treebeard is one of the most fascinating characters in the, you know, all these ants. Oh, love those things.
Could I say one
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, please do.
Because that kind of skips over this whole searching for him thing.
Yep,
This is the bit that has the little quote about being in a bit about being in a story where they're talking to the Rohirrim and they talk about these hobbits are halflings. Halflings, laughed the rider that stood beside Éomer. Halflings, but they are only a little people in old songs and children's tales out of the north. Do we walk in legends or on the green earth in the daylight? A man may do both, said Aragorn, for not we, but those who come after will make the legends of our time. The green earth, say you? That is a matter of mighty legend, though you tread it under the light of day. I'm like, ah! So now we can go on. I just love the way he's like, no, don't ever forget. We here are doing things that could be legend later.
Right, right.
And boy, so then why aren't we behaving like that?
Monday, when I go to work on Monday, that's the attitude I'm going to have.
Oh, I know, right? Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. You know,
dun, dun.
Yeah. I know. That's why I was like, why don't we think about that? Someday we'll be those people.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of an attitude adjustment almost.
Yeah,
is what it's calling for. It's like you think what you're doing doesn't matter, but it really does. It matters mm-hmm. more than you think.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's that idea for Catholics. The idea is every single person, their vocation is to become a saint.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what he's saying. Essentially, if we all were the people we're supposed to be, essentially live to our full potential, then yeah. that's what would happen. We would be the things of legend. And if you think about it that way and go, well, someday they should be talking about Saint Scott and Saint Seth and Saint Julie, you're like, whoa, what? Saint Julie wouldn't have done that.
I'm just trying to get my laundry done.
I know, right? But you'd have given an extra quarter to the lady who asked for it or whatever. Yeah. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Even that can be saintly. So anyway,
for
sorry.
Sure. No, that's great.
We're in
that really here. Is that really is a wonderful thing. Yeah, wonderful thing.
So before we even get to Fangorn, though, we get okay. we get the Uruk-hai, their whole experience and the conflict between the orcs and the different factions of orcs, and so we start to get a hint of how evil kind of is self-consuming in a way, or you know, mm-hmm. self-defeating.
Yeah, and this starts to give one hope. At least I did, you know, because okay, it's not a monolithic thing, you know. They've got problems within their ranks, so it makes them feel defeatable, you know.
Yeah, because to that point, there was no idea there could be a crack in the facade.
Right. It was like one monolithic bunch of evil, and then you realize, and it seemed obvious after it happens, but you know, they're not going to get along with each other. And
well,
they don't.
Gimli, when they're finding the helmets of the orcs and stuff, even Gimli makes a mistake. He's like, oh, white S, that's got to be Sauron. And Aragorn's like, no, I don't think so. I think, you know, the white isn't the color of
the white hand.
It's like not so, you know, even Gimli kind of makes the assumption like we are that you know, this is a monolithic thing where, in fact, there's more going on.
So, yeah, Merry and Pippin, they escape while they are fighting amongst themselves, and into the forest they go, and they pretty quickly meet.
Yes.
Treebeard.
So good.
Yeah.
What a great character.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
The shepherds of the trees.
Yeah, love that image.
I know. Well, and you guys know where that comes from, right? These characters, the idea for these characters.
I don't
know.
Nope.
Okay. When Tolkien was little, he read Macbeth.
And
he
could
not wait for the forest to come up to this castle. And he was so mad that it was just guys with branches on their helmets that he was like, I have been gypped, man. I've been ripped off. And so he made his own.
Oh, cool.
I thought that was so great. Talk about everything in somebody's experience going into a book, you know, ooh, here's what I would have liked to see. Not that he thought about it that way, but
that's exactly
really
why
cool.
I prefer reading fantasy to regular literary fiction. Just
yes.
The metaphor sometimes of literary fiction is just one too many steps removed for me. I kind of want,
from what we long and dream for, really.
Yeah.
And science fiction is that way too.
Oh yeah,
depending on the author, it allows you to still have that human desire and creative element in your own head about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I agree with that for sure. Says Treebeard, breaking his long silence. I have brought you about 70,000 ent strides, but what that comes to in the measurement of your land, I do not know. Anyway, we're in near the roots of the last mountain. That's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So they tell him, and he's a hastier ant. No, he's not hasty, but he can be.
Mm-hmm.
Quick beam. Yeah, quick beam is the one who they end up.
Then they have the ant moot, I guess.
I need to use that ant strides as a unit of measurement.
Yeah, just using your everyday speech.
Yeah. Very cool.
And then back with our heroes who were running after them and everything, which I also couldn't believe. Days and days. They're
days
running
and days
and
of running.
Running.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Like,
yeah.
Wow.
I always wonder how the dwarf can keep up.
Yeah.
I know he's hardy, but.
Yeah.
Yep.
I know. That had to be hard.
Well, they even make a lot of it in the story, too. And Aemir sees them like, we came from the river 3 days ago, and he's like, you did what?
You truly are men on a mission.
Yeah.
Holy moly.
I'm glad that they all had Air Jordans to wear.
Yeah, exactly. Pumps. You know? Yeah.
Well, Legolas can always do that really cool stuff. Like, he almost seemed to run over the grasses kind
of
thing.
Yeah, exactly. And on the top of the snow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
And then in they're in Fangor, they're cast down because they can't find any trace. And there was a huge fire of all the orcs, and so they're afraid that they're dead. And Aragorn shows us his amazing tracking skills for one thing, which I loved.
But, CSI Middle Earth,
they get into the forest. And they find an old man, and it's Gandalf.
Yeah, who, the White Rider.
Interestingly, doesn't even seem to remember who he is until they say his name. And he goes, oh, I remember that name.
Yeah,
you can call me that. And then he suddenly turns into Gandalf again.
Yeah.
It's kind of neat.
Yeah, that connection.
And I love, there was a part right in here that I highlighted that really caught me. He says, this is Gandalf. He's describing what happened to him, you know, so he was fighting a Balrog, and he said, we fought far under the living earth, where time is not counted. Ever he clutched me, and ever I hewed him, till at last he fled into dark tunnels. They were not made by Durin's folk, Gimli son of Gloin. Far, far below the deepest delvings of the dwarves, the world is gnawed by nameless things. Even Sauron knows them not. They are older than he. Now I have walked there, but I will bring no report to darken the light of day. Does that remind you of anybody?
I know, right? Do you feel like he read H.P. Lovecraft?
I'm wondering if he did, yeah.
Well, I mean, the other thing, go ahead. I totally interrupted.
No, you're not. No.
It makes me think because he was, you know, Tolkien studied Norse mythology, and Norse cosmology kind of envisions the world as a tree or kind of the framework as a tree. There's a world tree. And at the base of the tree, like kind of underneath, is a dragon kind of ever gnawing at the roots.
No kidding. Okay, worm, this is fascinating.
Yeah. Well, worm, dragon, and those words are kind of interchangeable.
Interesting. So, that's a cool thing.
But I don't know the Lovecraft illusion, so...
Well, Lovecraft is just always talking about nameless things. I mean, that's his horror, you know, everything.
That no one can describe because the horrors are too great.
It drives you insane.
To describe.
You see
well, first of all, language won't do it, but that's all. I have a feeling it was your Norse thing because he may have read them.
Yeah, I have a feeling it was the Norse thing too, but that makes me wonder, is that where Lovecraft got it?
Yeah. You know?
I mean, that's just an interesting connection. Maybe he was into that kind of stuff too.
He was more of an Arthur Machen, if that's how you say it, kind of guy. And Arthur Machen, who knows where he got his stuff, but he wrote about that kind of thing all the time.
Oh, wow.
Strange little people living in the, you know, from prehistoric times who are still alive and have done all these tunnels and will steal babies sometimes. I mean, you know, all kinds of really weird stuff.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
If you do that connection with the knowledge thing, you know, here it is. You've dug too deep, you know. And again, you know, there's that. But then he says, you know, now I have walked there, but I will bring no report to darken the light of day. And, you know, and there's the what do you call it? The two sides of the knowledge issue, really. Yeah. You've got one, if you know too much, it's dangerous, right? But yet the whole reason that they know or that the conclusion they've come to on the ring and what to do with it is based on their knowledge of the past.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like they're using knowledge in order to decide what the right thing to do is. But then on the other side, you've got, but there is such a thing as digging too deep. And I think that's just an interesting thing. You know, Tolkien has given us both of those things.
And then when you think about Gandalf's character, it doesn't sound like this is information that we need or anybody really needs because who's going to be down there? So I agree with what Gandalf is saying. But if we think about what happens a little bit later on where he says, you know what? I should have been sharing a little more with everybody. Then you wouldn't have picked up the Palantir and looked into it. I'm going to start. And he's a lot suddenly on that ride with, is it Pippin?
Pippin,
he starts becoming a lot more forthcoming. And telling people things, he realizes he's been too secretive. So there's that aspect also of how much do you hold to yourself, which kind of is a double of Boromir.
Yeah.
Interesting.
If Boromir had talked more about what he thought, would people have been able to introduce better thinking for him? I mean, I don't know. I'm just, it's just kind of coming to mind. So
that makes sense.
I had a, well, he was a friend of mine, but he was an Episcopalian priest. And he told me one time, he says, "You've got to stop thinking by yourself."
Oh, you know,
it's like if you sit here with your philosophy and you think about it all the time and you're not talking about it, he says, you can go to some very strange places. And he was just saying, you know, it's another way of saying that you need community.
Mine's like a bad neighborhood. It's dangerous to go there alone.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's
hilarious.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't have anyone to go, no, turn there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you need someone to say, you know, that's ridiculous. You know, sometimes you need to be told that when you can convince yourself of almost anything, right?
And yeah.
If you say it out loud, sometimes just that will do it.
That's what I was just thinking. Where someone goes, you're telling me. And then you go, I did say that, but that's wrong. Yeah.
Exactly. So.
After they meet Gandalf, is the time when... Oh, were you done with your talking about
knowledge
and dark place? I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, no problem.
But after they meet Gandalf is when he says... They tell him everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he says... Gandalf says, "Poor Boromir. I could not see what happened to him." So he can tell more than he just can see right around him.
Yeah.
"It was a sore trial for such a man, a warrior and a lord of men. Galadriel told me he was in peril." Really? Mind to mind, what's going on here? But the other, but that's just struck me. But he says, "But he escaped in the end. I am glad. It was not in vain that the young hobbits came with us, if only for Boromir's sake. But that is not the only part they have to play. They were brought to Fangorn, and their coming was like the falling of small stones that starts an avalanche in the mountains. Even as we talk here, I hear the first rumblings. Saruman had best not be caught away from home when the dam bursts."
And burst it does.
Of course. Bang.
Heck yeah.
Yeah, it's that whole thing of these small, insignificant people made a difference just by being there and by being kidnapped and by getting away and by being themselves. And that continues in their part all the way through, because once they're separated, you know, you were talking about, Scott, about, no, not Pippin without Merry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the thing is, at some point, you have to be split off from that, or you yourself can't grow. You have to experience new communities, new things.
Right.
That's very true. Yep. Very
Doesn't
true.
Mean you're still not super glad to see each other as they were, but they have to. Yeah. And they were needed in different places to do different stuff.
Right. Right.
There's another part in the meeting when Gandalf rejoins them that Gimli is asking him about Saruman or something, and he's like, "Well, is he perilous?" The word perilous comes up, and Gandalf's like, "Well, yeah, he's perilous, but you know, I'm perilous. I'm probably the most perilous person you'll meet. Aragorn over there, he's perilous. You yourself, Gimli, are perilous." And so, you know, it's one of these instances where Tolkien and the modern fantasy community, Tolkien gets criticized for being very cookie cutter, very black and white. There's good and then there's evil. And there's a lot of truth to that. But there's also instances like this and a couple of others where he shows some kind of relativity, I guess, for lack of a better word, where you know, peril kind of depends on what side of the axe you're standing on.
Right, yeah. Right.
I just look at that and I go, I wonder if that was because he gets frustrated with how people use words to be black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And he himself was so good at him. He's like, "Well, no, what define your terms, sir?"
Yeah.
You know, what are you talking about here?
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. And right around here, Gimli says, "Men need many words before deeds." I like that sentence too. He was getting frustrated. He's like, "You guys talk a lot. Can we do something now?" And it's funny, you know, again, that's a contrast with the Ents.
You know? Right.
So Gimli wants action and the Ents want to talk.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
This is also where, it's funny, this must be where, this is, I guess, Tolkien's chance to kind of go, let me just kind of make a few things a little clearer. And of course it does. But when, at one point, Gandalf is saying, well, thanks to Saruman, the enemy has failed. And Emily's like, what? And he says, well, is Saruman not a traitor? Indeed, yes, says Gandalf, doubly. Isn't that strange? And he says, nothing we've endured of late has seemed so grievous as the treason of Isengard. And it says, can I summarize? Anyway, he says, basically, he wanted to recapture the ring. So between them and his threats against the men of Rohan, which drew them off from Minas Tirith, everything combined to get these orcs, to get the hobbits to Fangorn as fast as orcally possible. Well, so humanly possible. He goes, they would never have been here otherwise. If these guys hadn't been messing around, none of this would have happened, and they were just where they needed to be to set other events in motion. And there's his luck again.
Yep.
And also this idea that evil itself fails because it's being so manipulative, mm-hmm. and it thinks it knows what it's doing, and it just can't, you know? Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, like I love that. That's really tail. Something. That's really something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's neat.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So, let's see.
Cool.
So where are we at? Okay.
Way to only halfway.
The King of the Golden Hall.
Moving on.
The King of the Golden Hall. So that's Theoden, isn't it?
Yeah, that's we get the whole Theoden right. Worm tongue.
Yeah. One of the things I learned in my research was that all of the king's names mean king in different languages.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Not even different languages. So Old English, Old North, the Germanic languages, they're big on wordplay, and so they have, you know, they come up with different words for king. And
everybody is king.
Wow. Yeah,
it's like a private joke that he loves. So Theoden and Éomer and Aragorn and I can't remember who else. Denethor.
No, he was a steward.
Oh, that's
No, I think it's just the kings of Rohan. I'm not sure if that applies to. Because the language that the Rohirrim speak is essentially Old English.
Okay.
And in fact, just from my own studies, I haven't heard anyone else say this, but they run into a guy at the Fords. His name is Churl, and that essentially just means guy. Like, it's related to the English word churl, you know, churlish.
Uh-huh. Right.
It's just a dude.
So that's hilarious. That always
struck
me
as like slightly comical.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I love to think of him going through and going, I don't know what to call him. Well, I'll call him this for now.
Yep.
That's good enough.
Yeah.
Heck yeah.
So this also introduces Eowyn.
Eowyn, right?
Who is the only one of the things that Tolkien is also criticized for is his lack of major women characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I'm going to say.
You know, that surprises me because.
Bothered me.
Yeah, Eowyn was fantastic. And. To have her do what she did, I thought would have been kind of rare in fiction at this time.
Well, yes, but here's the thing. What does she do in the way that a lot of people look at this? She's heroic. She does this stuff. She proves herself, and then she gets married and says she's going to be a healer. Back to the women's world.
I see.
And the thing is, just since this is going on so long, I'm just going to skip ahead to this little comment, which is that what is forgotten, and I always knew I didn't agree with that, but I never could put my finger on why. And again, I have to thank Corey Olson. But what he points out is the person who helps her see that the only way to be a noble, upstanding person is not to be in battle is Faramir.
Mm-hmm.
Faramir is the one who says, you know, we used to be a higher people, but now we're like the Rohirrim. We just think of war. Right. We used to plant gardens and heal people and this and that. And so the more he talks about it, there's a parallel with Gandalf when he brings Theoden out into the light and just says, look around. His healing of him is just to get him to come out and look in the light at the real world. And he kind of blinks his eyes and goes, wait, and starts waking up. And what happens is she goes outside and starts talking to Faramir, who's talking about, oh, well, you know, gardens and healing and blah, blah, blah. And to a quick summary. And but basically that helps her. This is going on too long. Moving on. She gets a different point of view and she suddenly says, oh, I'm allowed to do those things. It's kind of like in the Rosie Project, which I read, where the guy's like, I rebooted my brain while she was gone, and then I could think of it like this. She gets a whole different orientation.
That is cool.
And says, oh, well, if these things are okay, then, oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so they together are going to do that. It's not just her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
interesting. Yeah. So maybe from now on, maybe we shouldn't go through the books like we're going through them because it is going so long. We could just kind of hit kind of major things for the rest of what we got going on.
Got it.
So the Palantir is that's what Sauron's eye is. Is one of those stones. So Sauron actually exists, but his eye is one of those stones.
Like magnified through the Palantir?
I guess, but I think it's actually a Palantir.
Really?
That's what I gathered.
I think it's his eye.
You think it's his eye?
I think he has a horrible cat-like eye.
Well, I think it's the Palantir is what's on the tower.
Oh, you know what
I mean? I mean, he may be looking in a Palantir or something like that, but that's what I thought it was.
He definitely, it's one of his tools for sure, but I almost got the sense that he uses that more as I don't know. You know, I never thought of it.
He bears his will on people with it.
Right.
That's what he does to Denethor.
So if you have a Palantir, unless you're Aragorn, basically, you fall under his control.
That's a beautiful moment.
Yeah.
Heck yeah.
So I don't know, actually. It's possible. I hadn't really thought of it in my reaction.
But of course I don't have it marked, so I can't prove it. So I'll have to look it up. But
when I read it,
I thought, oh, is that what it is? So, but anyway.
It's a component of his fascist big brother state, for sure.
Yeah. No question.
He is watching us through his TV.
Yeah.
No question. Yeah.
Well, when you talk about the Palantir, though, that's another one of those moments when I can't remember if it's then or a little bit later that Gandalf says, well, actually, this is another good one we can chalk up to these young hobbits because I probably would have tried this myself and I might have been caught.
Uh-huh.
Says, but luckily, since it happened to whoever Pippin. It was, I can't keep them straight.
Yeah, Pippin. I know.
Luckily, since it happened to Pippin, I know the danger. I will not try it. He goes, it's awful that it happened, but thank goodness it happened the way it did. That was pretty lucky. Wink, wink.
Yeah, yeah.
The great thing about it is, too, that Sauron sees Pippin. He assumes the Palantir is still in Orthanc. He assumes Saruman's got one of the hobbits, and Sauron's like, oh, no, you didn't.
Yeah.
he's sending some Nazgul.
Yeah, exactly, because they're all busy thinking the very worst thing they possibly can think.
And it all goes back to something that was said at the Council of Rivendell. I think that's where it was said, is Sauron's only measure for measuring things and evaluating things is power. And so, you know, they just don't think of, you know, the idea, and that's why this plan of destroying the ring is like so foolish, it's brilliant, is just not, it's not that, it's just, it's not on the radar at all.
We're going to send off this little guy.
Yeah.
Who can do anything with this ring around his neck. And by the way, we're going to send off these other people who could leave him at any time. We gave him permission. I only had one point that I wanted to say about really quick. And this was Pippin talking to Gandalf when Gandalf's like, what the heck were you doing with the Palantir? Come on. And he's like, I wish I'd known all this before, said Pippin. I had no notion of what I was doing. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, you had, said Gandalf. You knew you were behaving wrongly and foolishly, and you told yourself, though you did not listen.
Right, yeah.
And like, oh, human nature, here we go.
Yep.
Just that's like, it, yep.
Yeah, how many times do we do that? And then you try that stupid excuse. It's life. That's, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
That's
sorry.
It. And he also says something about that he's learned his lesson, and what touching the fire teaches better than didn't he say something like that? Touching the fire teaches better than
burned hand. If I had spoken sooner, it would not have lessened your desire or made it easier to resist. On the contrary, no, the burned hand teaches best.
That's
after
it.
That yeah. advice about after that advice about the fire goes to the heart.
There you go. So that's what you do as a parent. You sometimes you try to tell them that something's about to go wrong and they won't listen.
Yeah.
And then you've got to let him go ahead and do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I remember one time, you can even do it a different way, because I remember one of my kids was a toddler and we were across the street talking to a neighbor, and this, I think it was Rose, she kept wanting to walk in the street and she was old enough to know. And finally, about the fourth time, I just gave her a huge whack on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
She started crying and my neighbor looked at me like I was a monster. And I said, would you rather have her walk into the street when I'm not looking and get hit by a car? Would you rather have her hit like this and remember it's going to get you something?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He just turned his back on me. And I was like, really?
Oh, man.
You know, so.
Jeez.
Anyway.
Well, I think that was the right move for what it's worth.
Yeah. Not turning your back on me.
Parenting lessons from Middle Earth.
Yeah, that's right.
Pippin, Gandalf, and Julie D.
.com. I'm buying the URL right now.
I think we need the Batman and Alfred thing. Batman and Frodo.
Heck yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Let's see. Yeah.
Now we move on to Gollum. And book four is the Gollum book.
It pretty much is. It really is. Yeah. The Taming of Sméagol is the first chapter. And then we're going through Herbs and Stewed Rabbit, all kinds of stuff, all the way to Shelob's lair where the spiders are. And then the chapter 10 is the greatest chapter in book four, the choices of Master Samwise, where he tried, so at the end of this chapter, Frodo and Sam have been trudging along the whole time. They see Sméagol. Sméagol is who's their guide. Sam really dislikes Sméagol. He knows there's something not right about this whole deal the whole time. And then, Frodo gets captured by a spider, which, Gollum led them to. And, Sam thinks he's dead. Mm-hmm. Does he find out he's not dead right in that chapter 10? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah,
okay. So
he overhears
at the end, right?
Yeah, at the very end. Okay. Yeah. And then he's got the ring now. Sam actually has the ring.
Yeah.
And has to decide what to do. And of course, what he does is probably obvious to all of us, is that he goes to save Frodo.
Right.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing was, I still remember, it's talking about when Sam hears them talking about, she's not dead, she's just poisoned him, she'll eat him later. And it says, Sam reeled, clutching at a stone. He felt the whole dark world was turning upside down.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's kind of how I felt when I was listening to Corey Olson's podcast. And he said, well, it's talking about the choices of Sam. Sam didn't have to take the ring and leave Frodo. And I went, what? My whole world reeled around me. Because to me, that was such the obvious thing. You had to do that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I suddenly started thinking about the implications of when, because later he says, you fool, you followed your head and not your heart. You knew you should have stayed with him. And I was like, what would have happened?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe he would have been there. He could have drug him off in a ditch to bury him. He would have wakened up. They would have gone on their way without having all this other stuff happen with the orcs.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, it would have been a whole different situation. And so when I thought about it like that, talk about really skipping ahead.
Mm-hmm.
When I thought about it like that, I suddenly went, in a sense, when you think about it like that, it's the picture of, here's God outside of time. Here's this big plan. You're going along. You decide you're going to do this, which is completely wrong. That's okay.
Yeah.
We can get you back on track.
Mm-hmm. Course correct. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's going to hurt like hell, but I can't help that. We're moving on. Keep cooperating.
That's right. That's right.
That conversation between the oaks. Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
That conversation between the orcs, by the way, is the other example I was thinking of, where it kind of flies in the face of that whole good versus evil. Evil is just this faceless, because those orcs are like, man, after this is over, we just want to go somewhere and kick back. And there's this whole conversation they have, like, the boss doesn't always make the right decisions either. So there's this whole and so it's hard to tell exactly, most of the time the orcs really are just faceless cannon fodder, but it seems like at least Tolkien does try to put the shoe on the other foot. And they say something really insightful, like, and to neither side really cares about us. And if the big guy falls, they're just going to they're going to take us out too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think in that sense, he's really good at showing the shading of how a lot of times there isn't all good or all evil. It's again, it's the what choices are you making? What are you going to ally yourself with in those smaller characters?
Yeah.
Like Sam, like those orcs, like, you know, even Butterbur, those kind of people. And it's the big characters. Maybe that's what those people are always thinking of, because the big themes of the book are good and evil. And the big characters, Aragorn is noble and good. The Nazgul have made their choice. They are committed to it. They are evil.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and in fact, Saruman, because Gandalf gives him the choice, which I did think was interesting. He's like, you give me your staff and all these things and I'll let you go. And he goes, oh yeah, what are the conditions? He goes, no, no conditions, complete freedom. You go wherever you want. And he goes, oh yeah, under those conditions, I'll just stay here. Thank you. Yeah. And you're just like, wow, you are choosing time and time and time again the wrong way, because you just don't get it.
The whole idea of hope too is important throughout all this thing, you know, and that's what Sam provides. There's something that I highlighted. It says, at that moment, a rolling and rumbling noise was heard again, louder now and deeper. The ground seemed to quiver under their feet. I think we're in for trouble anyhow, said Frodo. I'm afraid our journey is drawing to an end. Maybe, said Sam, but where there's life, there's hope, as my gaffer used to say, and need of victuals. As he most wise used to add, you have a bite, Mr. Frodo, and then a bit of sleep. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Classic Sam.
Yeah. It is classic Sam. But yeah, where there's life, there's hope, you know. And that, he kept providing that for Frodo, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Frodo would despair, and Sam would try to pick him up, and that just happened over and over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think that's why somebody like Sam was... oh, shoot. I lost my train of thought. Never mind. Sorry.
Okay. Well, we come back to that, too. Even after the ring's destroyed, and they think everything's blowing up.
Yeah.
And Sam's like, hey, remember the Shire. You know, if we're going to go, let's at least think about pleasant stuff. And
right, right.
Sam can think about it. Frodo can't. Of course, you have to cut Frodo some slack, because he's been carrying around the ring for...
Mm-hmm.
He's had his finger bitten off and all that stuff.
Yeah, and Sam's like, gosh, you remember those hot dogs at Yankee Stadium? You know?
Can't even hear the bat creak anymore, Sam.
Exactly.
Well, it's funny because Sam's so practical and pretty hopeful and cheerful and everything. And the one thing he is not that way over is Gollum.
Yeah,
and none of us trust Gollum. But Sam is never the slightest bit charitable. And of course, the most what Tolkien called the most tragic moment in the whole book is when Gollum comes out and he sees the two sleeping and he's just been betraying them to Shelob the spider. And he suddenly turns more into how he was, an old, weary hobbit, shrunken by the years that had carried him far beyond his time, an old, starved, pitiable thing. Wow. And that's when Sam wakes up and says, what have you been up to?
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing. Sneaking. Nice, master. Where have you been? What have you been up to? Sneaking like around like old villain. And then he changes back. And it's funny because he got letters from people who were upset because, you know, Sam sent him off, kind of ruined his chance for redemption. He's like, oh, no, wait. That wasn't Sam's fault. Sam was right. He was sneaking off. He was doing these things.
Yeah.
But he'd already chosen. He's like, but that was his last chance. And it's too bad Sam reacted that way. But it wasn't Sam's fault that he reacted that way.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
He was right.
I mean, that's actually an example of Sam's rationality. Another, you know, the rational thing is to, as Faramir, you know, Faramir really wanted to read Gollum the Riot Act, and he
was
not that was the rational response. And Frodo's operating on being a ring bearer just seems to completely shift your perception of things, so that that whole relationship was just a little bit beyond comprehension.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So now we are in book 5. We're in The Return of the King. Excuse me. I'm losing my voice.
It's only been 12 hours. Don't worry. We'll get through these marshes soon.
That's right.
Midwater.
So let's see. Book 5, Chapter 1 is Minas Tirith. It's when Pippin and Gandalf arrive at Minas Tirith. And I can't remember. I think they see Denethor right away.
Pretty much, yeah.
And that's when Pippin says, you know, you have my sword or whatever. He pledges himself.
Like, what?
Yeah. Sorry. That's right.
Sorry. Wrong moment.
Yeah, wrong moment. but yeah, that was a good moment. And
I liked what Gandalf said after that. You know, Pippin asked, like, did I do okay? And Gandalf's like, you did great. I wouldn't have done it that way. I'm paraphrasing here. Mm-hmm. I'm not like Julia and marked everything, but Gandalf's like, you did great. I wouldn't have done it that way, but I wasn't going to stop you. And he says something like, a deed done from kindness shouldn't be counteracted with cold counsel or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, even though Gandalf, you know, rightly sees some problems with Pippin aligning himself with Denethor, you know, sees that this is coming from a really good place and is not going to stop that.
Right, right.
Oh, yeah, and I never thought about this till now, but that's another one of those moments. If he hadn't offered his sword, he wouldn't have been allowed full access, so he could have gone belting around and going, get up there and stop the Lord. He's getting ready to set everybody on fire, and I got to go find Gandalf. And, you know, that's what allowed him to make the friends that restored right action, basically.
Yeah,
right.
True. Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Wow. Yeah, so good.
Then we sort of get a parallel the next chapter or two with Merry and Théoden.
Yeah.
And Merry offering Théoden his service.
Right, right. And being rebuffed.
Yeah, and we get another echo that all the way from back at the beginning when we were talking about the conspiracy and Frodo trying to leave the hobbits behind of, hey, we don't know what we can do. Merry's like, I don't know how I'm going to help on the battlefield. I want to, you know, this is why I pledged myself to you. I want to be there. And Théoden's like, no.
and he says the same thing to his daughter, too. Yeah, Eowyn.
Yeah.
And therefore they go anyway, right?
Yep, pretty much.
We're following our heart on this.
They follow. Yeah, they both go together.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say also during this period in these few chapters is where Aragorn and Gimli and Legolas go off on their own to
Paths of the Dead.
Yeah, the Paths of the Dead, right.
Ooh. Yep. It was amazing.
Right, right. I'm just moving the plot forward, but go ahead. If you have something to say, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, when we were talking about Denethor versus Théoden, and they've each got their own hobbit, and the way they treat their hobbits says so much about each of these people in power, one of whom is an actual king, and one of whom is a steward who has forgotten he's a steward
and is
acting like he's the king. One is completely loving and, you know, like, oh, someday we'll sit and have pipes and tell stories together, says Théoden.
Mm-hmm.
And Denethor is like, you know, pushing him around and
sing me
not
a song.
Being terrible, but he's very cold and he's mostly so full of self-pity he can't think of another thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And so then you have that, and then you have Denethor's self-pity versus Éomer's last stand when they see the Corsair ships, which is a fantastic moment when you're listening.
Cool. Oh. So good. Yeah.
Cool, cool.
And that's that Corsair thing, by the way, is what Tolkien called eucatastrophe.
Oh, right, right.
And it happens several so it's this idea that, you know, this moment when everything looks like it's coming apart, but it in fact turns to the good. That's what the I think, at the beginning of it, the Greek extension, Greek prefix for good. So it's, you know, it's something that seems at the moment to be awful, but is turned to good.
Yeah, it's a good catastrophe.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, that's a cool word.
Yeah.
Yeah. So nice. So where do we go from there? The Pyre of Denethor.
Yeah, and the only thing I have to say about that is that just that creepy image of, you know, if someone tried to use that palantir from then on, unless they were really strong-willed, all they could see was a couple of, like, flaming hands.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
it's such a powerful image. and just the idea, the danger of the Palantir of kind of eating. It's again the whole knowledge thing, and the Palantir destroying Denethor and also Saruman's minds by, you know, showing them untruths and that sort of thing, or half truths or exaggerations.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's that you think you can talk to the enemy and you'll be immune.
Right.
But all you're doing is giving an opening to be worked on.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I like this. This is not the Palantir. I guess I'm skipping around more. This is the Ride of the Rohirrim. But I was thinking about the enemy and this whole idea, and I guess that's the thing of, you know, don't open yourself up to the enemy, but the enemy also is not as powerful as it thinks it is. And so he's, then when it's really dark all the time, which when he's suddenly, you know, the power of Sauron is there because it's nighttime all the time. Day's not coming again.
Right, right.
And that takes the heart out of everyone. But on the other hand, yeah. Amor's out there and he goes, good tidings. Even in this gloom, hope gleams again. Our enemy's devices oft serve us in his despite. The accursed darkness itself has been a cloak to us. And now, lusting to destroy Gondor and throw it down stone from stone, his orcs have taken away my greatest fear. The outlaw could have been held long against us. Now we can sweep through if we can get that far.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. And I'm just like, time after time after time, the things they're doing to help themselves turn against them.
Right, right. Turning good out of bad.
Right, because yeah. The right people are there trying and trying and trying and trying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and then after the whole battle, we get the whole Houses of Healing thing, which we've kind of talked about already in mm-hmm. regards to Eowyn. Right. And then we get something that is really great, and that whole the last debate chapter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where, you know, it's like, okay, we've won this, and it feels like the epic end to a movie, but you get the sense that, okay, this is just the first wave, like... It's like mm-hmm. finishing an epic movie, and then you realize, oh, we've only gotten through the opening credits. Like, there's going to be more and more and more of this. And you get the thing I like about this chapter is that you get a sense of other peoples of Middle Earth, like especially Prince Imrahil from Dol Amroth, the kind of the seafaring area. So, you know, you get tantalizing glimpses of these other places that you just love to learn more about.
Yeah, and they get together and they make a decision, right? And they decide what they're going to do is attack Mordor.
Yeah.
And the reason they're going to attack Mordor is because they are assuming that Sam and Frodo are still alive, and they want Sauron looking their way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so they want to disrupt... Or give them an opening to get through.
Yeah. Isn't that great?
Yeah, it's fantastic. It and then there's another thing that happened in this chapter that really struck me. And that was there was people who didn't want to go. And And Aragorn let them go. He said, not only that, but he gave them something else to do.
Yeah.
It wasn't like you know, go in shame. It was like, yeah, go, but go do this.
Go do something more fitting to your talents.
Exactly
or,
yeah. right. Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, this isn't good for you anyway. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was neat. I thought that was, you know.
And then that whole section ends with a cliffhanger of the Mithril, the mouth of Sauron, you know, showing the Mithril, and Gandalf is the only one who's kind of completely unfazed by it. It's like, all right. He's not unfazed. I can't remember if it describes him having an internal. He's. Externally, he's completely unfazed.
They don't show an internal anything. He says, neither shall we. If this be jest, then it's too bitter for laughter. And he holds up his sword, Andoril, held it glittering in the sun. You shall not be sheathed again until the last battle is fought, he said. Woo!
And Gandalf says right before that, and there are names among us that are worth more than 1,000 mail-clad knights of peace. That was cool.
No. He says, yeah. No, he will not smile.
Right, right.
It's like, he's not going to be happy about this.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. The thing this brings to mind is that movie, The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise.
Oh, yeah.
Where the last thing he and Ken Watanabe, I can't remember his Japanese name, but they're there and he goes, how did that battle end? And that Greek battle end? And he goes, they died to the last man. And they give each other these grins and they go, all right, let's go.
Yeah.
And it's that feeling that I get from this chapter is like, yeah, you know?
Yeah.
Woohoo.
Heck yeah.
Very nice. I don't know why more girls don't read this book.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it.
I have to say, one of the things that my oldest daughter says, that when she's like meeting guys who are, you know, they're trying to see if they would like to date, and they'll always go, what are your favorite movies? And she starts naming them. They're like, I never knew a girl who likes so many action movies. Let's go out.
That's awesome. Yeah.
That is good.
That's my daughter.
That's cool.
Okay.
All right. So the next chapter is called The Black Gate. So that's the arrival of the army at the Black Gate. And starting to make some noise.
Yep.
And then the switches in book 6. Now we're back with Sam and, well, Sam.
Yeah, pretty much.
Frodo's all tied up. Yeah. Frodo's all, he's in a cocoon or whatever, waiting to be eaten by orcs.
Yeah,
and Sam figures out a way to get in there and get him out. And
so we see more
chaos.
Yeah,
but the way he gets him out. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I think you were going to the same place I was.
Okay, well, go ahead.
The way he gets him is that the enemy does the work for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, the tower is like, Sam's like, oh, I'm going to fight all these orcs. Oh, whoa, goody, they're already dead. Yes.
Yeah. And each battle.
Yeah. And then there's that moment where the ring, you know, he gives the ring back to Frodo, and you get sort of a reprise of that moment with Frodo and Bilbo in the Rivendell. Mm-hmm.
There you go. Yeah. Another double.
Yeah. You can see what he's been struggling against. Well, and Sam now has a fellow feeling because he felt that ring for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He understands a touch of what his master's going through. And what I was going to say is what I found super interesting is before all that, or at some point during all that, Sam's stuck. He doesn't know what to do. And against all, it says, to his own surprise, there at the vain end of his long journey and his grief, moved by what thought in his heart he could not tell, he began to sing. He's sitting on the steps. It's all lost. I'm just going to sing. And as he sings, his voice gets stronger, louder. He sings this other song that with words of his own that came up to fit the tune he was singing. And then he hears somebody singing back and he's like, holy crap, that was Frodo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one of these things where it's inexplicable, really, but it's the simple, fully human thing. You know,
mm-hmm.
He doesn't know why he sings. But it's kind of beautiful that he finds him through song.
Yeah. It is beautiful. It's like an expression. Perfect. What else is there to do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of a deeply human thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, okay. So they get out of there. And
then they fall in with orcs. And didn't you have something to say about this, Julie?
Yeah, that was the thing I was going to say, where they're dressed in the orc costume, or the orc armor, because that's all they had, and they were going in disguise, and they had to go along the main road.
Yeah,
so there was no other way to get by, and all of a sudden here comes this huge company of orcs, and they're like, oh, maybe they won't take us. They're like, oh, you slackers, get in here.
Yeah.
And they are racing them down the road, and they're hitting them with whips, and don't you slow down. And they're just like, Sam's like, oh my gosh, Frodo's never gonna make it. And they make it, and they find a place where they can kind of throw themselves over the side of the road. But they made time like they would have never made otherwise. If those orcs hadn't picked them up, the orcs got them to where they needed to be in time.
That's true.
So that when Sauron's being distracted, they're at the right spot. And they wouldn't have been there if that hadn't happened. And that was luck again.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Wink, wink, nudge,
nudge. Absolutely right.
The big plan. Awesome. Like, well, I didn't tell you to take that ring and go with it, but here's where we have to go to do this thing.
Yeah.
Make it happen.
Yep.
Very good. Very good. So cool. So, and then all, well,
takes us to Mount Doom, essentially.
Yeah, that takes us to Mount Doom, essentially. So then the big event at Mount Doom.
Showdown with the OK Corral.
Yep, the showdown, the big moment we've all been waiting for, which is interesting that it happens in Chapter 3 of 9 of Book 6.
Yeah.
So they get to Mount Doom. They look over at the lava. And Frodo says, no, I'm not going to do it.
I can't do it anymore. And that was the most horrible moment ever. Poor Sam. What?
It's one thing if he just said, I can't do it. But he's defiant. And it's
yeah.
You know, yeah, you're right. He's like, I will be the Lord. I will wear the ring. This is it.
Yeah.
You're right. That's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that he can't hold out anymore. He's just not holding out anymore, and the result is the defiance.
Right.
Contrast it with Jesus at Gethsemane, where it is just sort of, I don't know if I can do this. It's not something like that. It's outright defiance.
Right. Yeah, Jesus at Gethsemane is actually, I will do this if you want. I'm asking you not to make me have to do it.
Yeah.
Whatever you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, at his very last words are, it is done. And that's him voluntarily giving his life up.
Mm-hmm.
So to the very end, he's obedient.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Frodo was not Christ. So.
Right. So Frodo, that's Frodo's moment of failure. And then here comes Gollum, who we haven't seen for a while. Yeah.
Who we've had pity on.
Yes.
And it's a good thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right, and
pity and mercy to temper that justice.
Right,
and Gandalf set that ball rolling way back, and if he hadn't done that, it could have been bad.
Yeah, we've all got our parts to play and all that.
Yeah.
Bilbo could have killed him. In fact, that's a part that went back and got rewritten.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Stayed his hand.
The original Hobbit, they played the game of riddles, and the ring was in a ring of invisibility, but it was nothing, of course, bigger. And Gollum said, oh, well, okay, bummer that I lost, because it was a children's book, but here you go.
Yeah.
So he went back and rewrote the whole thing. So when he had that moment of pity, that sets everything in motion, because he could have stabbed him, and then he realized what it was like to be under that power.
Yeah.
And living in the dark all the time. And he couldn't.
Yep. Yeah.
So, yeah, full circle.
Full circle.
Yeah, that's loving your neighbor as yourself. You don't have to, people mistake that and think you have to love them. You just have to want the good for them you would want for yourself.
Right.
That's the love. And that's what started the whole ball. And you're right. Then Gandalf really emphasized it and picked it up at the beginning several times. So.
Yeah.
And again, evil does the job for you because he's not trying to take it to save everything. He wants it for himself.
No.
Yeah, that's
right. There's no altruism at all in what he does. Yeah,
it's the ultimate expression of that. It's just not going to win. If you've got to do your part, or they wouldn't have been there with the ring. But
right. Yep. And then Gollum does his thing, bites a finger off, falls into the lava with the ring in the finger. Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get all this wrap-up.
So he completes the quest, And then when we get chapter 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 of
which
wrap-up.
Which we were talking about at the very beginning of the podcast.
Yeah.
Of being such a daring thing for Tolkien to do. One of you was saying, a modern editor would probably never, allow this.
He probably would not. We'd get a chapter, maybe.
Yeah,
to wrap it
an
up.
Epilogue. You'd get an epilogue.
Exactly.
But it's really important. There's so much good stuff.
There's so much good stuff. And the part that I was talking about at the beginning was the scouring of the Shire, when they go back to the Shire finally. And the Shire is in completely different shape. I enjoyed them talking to the guy at Bree. What's his name again? Butterbur?
Butterbur.
Yeah, talking to him and how it's changed there. And then they go into the Shire and there's strong arm people there that have kind of taken stuff over, and there's Saruman and Wormtongue are there, kind of directing things, and they've changed though. These guys have changed, and they took care of it, get those people out of there.
There are a couple of neat things. One of the great things with Butterbur is they're telling Butterbur, hey, there's a king again down south. Things are going to get better. And Butterbur's like, yeah, this king is not going to do anything for me in this place. Yeah. He probably doesn't even know I exist. And he's like, well, actually, the undergrowth guy, you're always a...
Yeah.
You know him.
Yeah. And then the other thing I was thinking was we were talking about Chekhov, and you know, if there's a gun in the first scene, it needs to go off. And it makes the mithril coat makes me think of that because, you know, you know, Bilbo gives Frodo the coat, and you know it turns a couple of orc arrows here and there, but you never really think anything of it, and you kind of forget about it. And then you know Saruman goes after Frodo. And he's not expecting it, and it turns turns the blade, really turns the turns things in their favor.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a really interesting. I mean, that whole thing was really interesting and really satisfying.
There were two things for me in there also. One was how much the thing I actually loved about all the way this is handled, all these different things. He takes them so slowly into this very dangerous world, and then he takes them very slowly back into the regular world.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of easing you back out of it.
Right.
And so when they hear it's all dangerous, and they're like, what, Gandalf, you're not going to come with us? And he goes, you don't need me anymore. You're fine.
Yeah.
And you realize that I was kind of surprised they even asked Gandalf for help, because even Merry and Pippin have had swords and know how to fight. And it made me think of, I'm in the middle of replaying Baldur's Gate right now, Shadows of Am. And, you know, you start off one of those games, you're like, oh no, attacked again, nobody's strong, no one knows how to do anything, I don't have any potions. But by the time you get halfway through, you're like, oh, more bandits, fine. And you just take care of it. And that's how it struck me. Okay, fine. We'll just do this. Yeah. We're used to it.
Pretty much.
So it really shows you, it's the best illustration I've ever seen of how much they've been changed and they don't even know it because they've been out of their own environment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that I thought was so poignant, but as you say, satisfying, Scott, is the way that Saruman ends. He's treacherous and horrible to the very end, and he dies, and that, is it dust or shadow or whatever, comes up and looks to the west like, do you think I could? And the wind just blows him away.
Nope.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, you have chosen, you've never been repentant a second. Boromir.
He chose poorly.
Well, and speaking of Boromir, turned away time after time, he could have changed or shared or whatever. It's a very small double. But he realized what he did, and he was sorry, and he paid for it.
Yep.
Not
for
here.
Sure. Yeah, but not in this case.
Yeah. And then the other thing that always really disappointed me was the going when poor Frodo had no peace and wound up going into the West.
Yeah.
I see that now. Now it does work for me.
Oh, yeah.
I was too young before for it to seem just.
Yeah. It's like, oh, you should have come home. Yeah, because... Well, even at the beginning, they make a lot about, you know, Bilbo and Sam are both talking about Bilbo. Bilbo's talking about finishing his book, and he's like, I want it to end, and they lived happily ever after till the end of their days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it just doesn't. Well, it does. It ends that way for Sam.
Yeah, it does. For Sam, it does. Yep.
Well, and we're all talking, though, as if going into the West was a bad thing. And actually going into the West was something that's really good. And so that's very similar, too, of, you know, we love life itself and we should.
Yeah.
But when it's time to go, there's something else waiting. That's the going into the West.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We miss the people who've gone, and we should be excited, like, what's happening? After we get on the boat, something great will happen. We get to go into the West.
Yeah.
So that was another realization, is that, you know, because I understand from hearing Corey Olson talk that it says that Sam later got to go into the West because wore the ring for a very short time, and the ring bearer could go.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's in one of the appendices, too, that Gimli ends up going into the West. And, you know,
yes.
He's the only dwarf who ends up, you know, because the dwarves are, like, thoroughly of Middle Earth.
Right.
Do we have time for me to tell the creation story of the dwarves? Because it's actually one of my favorite parts of the Silmarillion.
Yeah. And,
go ahead.
And then Legolas waits for Gimli, by the way.
Oh, really? Right. Pretty much. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got some more to read.
So, yeah, the dwarves, so there are two races, and I'll simplify it because there's so much in the Silmarillion, but Ilúvatar is the kind of father god figure. And then there are these sort of manifestations of him, kind of sub-gods. I guess you could read sub-creation into that. And so Ilúvatar kind of sets this whole thing out. He's like, okay, I'm going to create two peoples. I'm going to create elves and men, and they're going to show up here in Middle-earth. And so your job is to get this place ready for them. And so one of the kind of minor deities, whose name is Aule, and he's kind of the deity of Earth, he just can't wait for these guys. He's like, I can't wait for these elves and men to show up. I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to make my own people. And so he does that, and there's a big confrontation with Ilúvatar, and Ilúvatar says, I'm not gonna undo what you did, but there are consequences. And so that's why the dwarves are kind of often seen as kind of lesser, or you know, kind of wicked step kids in a way.
Okay.
Interesting.
So, yeah, that's really interesting.
Silmarillion is
like it's like mining diamonds in the rough, because you know you go through these long lists of characters or battles and stuff, and you're like, oh, when is this gonna? And then you get a little story like that or a little nugget every once in a while. It's like, oh, that makes this fall into place.
Hmm. Oh yeah. See, you need to edit a book of the nuggets. I know that Christopher Tolkien would never allow it.
Silmarillion nuggets. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. tasty.
Well, I have something for the end when we're done.
Okay.
One very, very short thing, but whenever that is.
Are we there?
I'm done.
Okay.
I just want to say this.
Yeah, definitely a 5-star book.
yeah.
As it said, you know, this my feelings on it is that it does transcend the genre. You know, people say, you know, this is an epic fantasy, but that term doesn't even apply. It's almost as if this is its own thing, and then everything else is a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a genre of its own, in my opinion. Think it's remarkable and stunning.
Yeah, I agree. And it's one of those, you're not ready to experience it until you're ready, and you get different things out of each time you read it. But you know, people do read it, or have tried to read it, I've talked to, and like, I couldn't get into it. So, you know, maybe they'll try again in 5 or 10 years or whenever, and it'll be time.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah.
my hope.
Right, right.
And you appreciate it. Yeah, like me. Mm-hmm. So recent.
And me.
Yeah. Well, and I think of what Jenny said about The Hobbit on your Reading Envy podcast, which was, you know, she felt it felt familiar. You felt at home there.
Yeah.
And the thing that Tolkien does is he so skillfully takes us from the things that are so homely into things that are so much higher and better and nobler. And he gives us back some of those feelings that people must have had during the Middle Ages when they listened to the stories of the great heroes. But he gives it to us in a way that we can relate to it and have some of those feelings back again ourselves. And it's just, it's such a great book.
I will be reading it again.
Oh yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
Might have to listen to it soon.
So. Yeah.
Heck yeah. Heck yeah.
Okay.
So thank you both very, very, very much.
You're welcome. I have my one last thing, though.
Oh, that was not it. Okay.
That wasn't it. No,
I'm ready for your one last thing.
Okay. Yeah. It's pretty short. I came across this. This is something. Okay. This is something I was told to pray for a while after one particular meeting with my spiritual director. So you can read into this what you want. But I think it's this to me is called the prayer of generosity. And to me, it defines what the people in this book are trying to do. The Frodo and Sam and Aragorn says, Lord, I want to love you, not that I might gain eternal heaven nor escape eternal hell, but simply to love you just because you are my God. Teach me to be generous. Grant me to give to you and not to count the cost, to fight for you and not to mind the wounds, to toil and not look for rest, to labor and to ask for no reward except the knowledge that I serve my Lord.
Beautiful.
That's awesome.
Yep.
It kind of says it all. And, yeah, you know, he sure very does. Carefully put no God in there, no religion. but that's what they're doing in trying to be the best they can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah.
This book makes you want to be better. It's it really one of those does. Things. Yeah. I mean, it honestly it really does. You know, that's not cliche. That's really honest. You know?
It's well, the beauty of it is that anybody can love the story.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that Seth said that I loved so much, that when he was little, even though he was thinking about The Hobbit also, but, you know, he understood the story and got the main parts. Anyone can love this story. And that's what Tolkien said. First, the story. The other truths that are in a story will come out later. He wasn't trying to hit you over the head with a hammer. Those things are there to be found. And if you don't want to find them, the truth of the story is enough that it will impel you to a better life anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because a good story is hard to find.
Evidently.
I love it.
But
and there was much rejoicing.
Yes.
Yay.
I love it. Very cool. Very cool.
Now that the podcast is done, there probably is much rejoicing.
Oh, man.
That was really fun, though. Wow. That was really fun.
I know. I loved it.
That was awesome.
The worst thing is I could have gone longer.
Yeah,
oh,
easy. Know, right? That's too funny. Wait a minute, if we could just start this over.
Yeah.
I kill you.
Oh, man.